Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, and I'm your chief investigator of images. Utterly excited today, as if my excitement levels can't get much higher. I am with someone who has just totally captivated me on the screen recently in her BBC 4 series, A Stitch in Time, Amber Butchart. Now, I wrote to you, didn't I? I said, oh, I love your programme so much. Do you want to do an art detective?
You did, and I, in fact, wrote back and said, oh my God, it's my favourite podcast.
Which was so nice.
I would love to. I would absolutely love to. We did have a bit of a love-in.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. We did have a mutual appreciation moment, yeah. Yeah. But this is brilliant because we're actually in the National Gallery. We've come into this really quite exciting private exhibition that's on at the moment.
Yeah.
Van Eyck and the Pre-Raffs. Because obviously, the thing I most wanted to do with you was the Arnold Feeney portrait. Your programme on it was amazing. Tell me a bit more about how the series came about.
Well, the series actually grew out of an Inside Versailles section that I filmed with Greg Jenner and Kate Williams.
Two of my dear friends, both been on the podcast too.
They have indeed. They have indeed, both brilliant public historians.
Yeah.
I filmed a section for that on fashion at the court of Louis XIV. Yeah. And based on that, the producers of the show just really enjoyed it. Loved the fact that we were talking about a painting and that you can, you know, tell all of this stuff about sort of society and politics at the time from the clothing that people wore and how this was represented in paintings. Now, I'd actually been in conversations with the BBC for quite a few years trying to pitch various stuff that had never really come off. And they sort of came up with the format of the show, which is absolutely brilliant. I love it so much. The fact that it mixes art history, fashion history, the actual, you know, recreation of garments.
Absolutely. That's the bit that just staggers me. I love it because there is that, always that sort of slight division between the object itself and how it's created. And there's always a hunger to understand the processes. But it's only when you see your lovely team working behind the scenes endlessly cutting that material. And it was things like looking at, I mean, we're standing in front of it. We're standing in front of this incredible painting, one of the top 30 paintings in the National Gallery, one of the most famous paintings from the Northern Renaissance. And it was things like the detailing on the pinch work at the front.
That,
I couldn't believe the agony that those people were going
through. I know. It is just unbelievable. That was one of the things I really wanted to get across with the show, the fact that we are so divorced from the making of clothing today, where all of us, we're so used to walking into a shop, buying anything we want to wear immediately, relatively cheap price points, you know. Mm. We've completely lost sense of the amount of labour that goes into this. The fact that for centuries, textiles were one of the most expensive things you would own. People would bequeath it in their wills. You know, we just have no idea of this in the 21st century. Mm. So when you look at a portrait like the Arnold Feeney portrait, the silhouette and the dress that this, the gown that she's wearing, is also so alien to 21st century eyes. But actually recreating it, and, well, for me, having the experience worn the recreation is just amazingly exciting and invaluable and just can tell you so much.
And I think you're right. I mean, even going back a generation, I remember constantly my mum having the sewing machine on the go, and you'd repair things and you'd fix things up or customise them. And we just don't do it as much now. But your work's interesting, isn't it? Because you're an academic as well as a broadcaster. But you look very closely at this relationship between fashion, culture, society. And of course, it's difficult for me as a medievalist because one of the things that's lost first are fabrics, things that are perishable.
Yeah.
But they can be the best documents of how people want to be perceived, how they want to represent themselves. They still are, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, similar to, you know, to art history, when you're looking at images, if you're thinking about a society that's largely illiterate, mm-hmm. then those kinds of visual symbols take on even more importance, you know, in terms of reading. Sort of status, wealth, gender, you know, all of these aspects of identity, these kind of visual clues are absolutely paramount.
I mean, I still do it today when I do sort of Anglo-Saxon jewellery. I'll say when a woman goes to choose an engagement ring, it can take months just to get the exact cut of the stain and the shape that they feel defines them best.
Yeah.
And there's a whole language of dress, jewellery, attire that each generation and each location has. And I find it fascinating what you do, sort of unpacking that and seeing what the clothes themselves tell you about the time.
Well, it's what I love about it is that it's a mixture. You've got you've got the sort of art historical elements, but you've also, it's this real focus on material culture. Mm. And what I love about the study of material culture is that from one object, you can look at it in so many different ways and it can tell us so many stories, as you know. you know, not only the actual finished object itself and what it represents, and what it's used for and why it was created, but the actual people who made it, the different stages that it had to go through, the materials it's made from, all of this, you could just, you know, you could go on forever and ever and ever just from one object. And that, it's fascinating.
And you studied fashion, but as an art historian?
No, I actually started off studying literature.
Did you like
yes,
me?
Yeah.
I was the same. Oh, my goodness.
I did a literature degree, first of all, at King's College
in London. I did not know that. How cool.
Yeah. And then after I finished my degree, I did not know what I wanted to do. I'd always loved reading and studying and writing. And I left university and felt a little bit lost. Mm-hmm. So I got a job at my favourite shop, which was a vintage clothing shop called Beyond Retro. And I quite quickly became the buyer for this shop. I'd always loved old clothes. I'd always loved the kind of stories that come with old clothes. So it was through working as the buyer that I started to get, essentially what was my first experience of material culture, I suppose.
Mm.
And I became obsessed with sort of researching the social history behind the pieces we were selling. And, you know, I would spend my lunch breaks like reading like fashion history books. And so after a while, I decided to do a master's at London College of Fashion.
Yes.
Which is where I still teach. And so there I really married up the, you know, the academic stuff, the theory that I'd always loved with the actual clothing itself, and it all kind of meshed together.
Amazing. And I think this is another argument that's in the newspapers at the moment about the value of humanities as in the job market. But I think we're both similar. We both love music, we love culture, we love literature, we love art.
Yeah.
And actually, there are so many useful directions for those passions to go in, aren't there?
Totally, yeah. I mean, I think it's invaluable. I mean, in terms of, you know, sort of understanding societies, cultures, understanding what's come before, understanding what it can tell us about the present world. I mean, it's just, and not to mention, you know, the critical skills that you learn, of course. And today, more important than ever, is the ability to look at sources and decide which sources are actually viable, are, you know, verifiable. I mean, in our post-fact
age. Oh, my
age,
God, exactly.
I mean, I think that the study of history is really
invaluable.
More important than ever.
Than ever. And, yeah. and visual culture. And this is something that, obviously, we're going to move towards the painting. It's been quite busy. Everyone's interested in it. But again, I think the job of the art historian, the work that you and I do in terms of trying to get people to look closely at old images to understand their own time better, this is... It's the most mysterious and enigmatic painting in many ways. It's been a problem for so many writers about art because what is it? Is it a marriage contract? Is she pregnant? Is she not? What's going on? It is a secular scene by Van Eyck, and Van Eyck's usually painting religious paintings. We know him best for things like the Ghent altarpiece. But in this case, we seem to be brought into a Netherlandish room and interior. You've obviously looked at this a lot. How does it make you feel, this painting?
Well, it's absolutely fascinating, this painting, isn't it? And it's arguably the best, the sort of most debated picture in Western art history, mm-hmm. I think, for a reason. I think that secular element that you mentioned is probably quite key to that. Mm. We do seem to be looking at quite an intimate sort of scene here. It looks like it's a bedroom. It looks like it's a couple, obviously. So all of these things immediately sort of, you know, make us interested. We want to know more. Who are these people? What's happening? I think that's why there have been so many theories about this. When I look at it, I mean, I've always just been bowled over by the green dress.
Have you?
That's the thing that I'm most drawn to. I mean, in most images, to be honest, I obviously always go to the clothing first.
Yes.
And it's green is one of my favourite colours. I even said that in the show.
Yes.
So I can't deny that, you know, that's something that just completely... But the way the fabric is actually depicted
a bit closer
in this painting as well.
It's only when you get yourself right up against it that you see... I mean, in your programme, you explored this area here. Is it called pelting? What do they call this bit?
It's called dagging.
Dagging, that's it.
Yeah.
And it's done with these long strips that are then folded back up on themselves. And it looked incredible in the finished piece that was made.
Absolutely incredible.
But I've never been able to understand the technology behind this. When I've looked at it, I've thought, I don't understand how that works.
Yeah.
Because there are these exceptionally long sleeves that almost come down to floor level, coated with the minerva or the fur there. And it just does... I couldn't understand how it had such depth and strength, but you explored all of that in the programme.
Well, exactly. And it is, you know, big shout out here to Ninia Michaela, the historical tailor on the show. She's an absolute genius.
I can't believe it, yeah.
She has skills that I absolutely don't have. I have tried to dabble in fashion design and, you know, making my own clothes at various points in the past. And I'm not very good at it, I'll be honest.
Oh.
I'm really bad at taking a flat piece of fabric and envisaging it as a 3D garment.
Yeah.
I'm really bad at it. What Ninia is brilliant at doing is deconstructing clothing from paintings.
Right.
And then obviously recreating them herself. So when she told me how these amazing sleeves were created, It blew my mind. Because similar to you, you look at it and you're just wowed, you're bowled over by this incredible image.
Well, also, I partly worry, when I used to look at this, before I saw your documentary, I used to think it was part fantasy. You know, like when you see the Virgin Mary in Van Eyck paintings, there's such exuberance of colour and texture and fabric, and you just think, no one in real life looks like that.
Yeah.
That's a religious figure who is sort of shown in the celestial realm. But these are not religious figures, they are people.
Yeah.
And this must be real, but there's so many elements of the dress that sort of defy logic. The dagging's part of it, but also there's this misconception that she's pregnant, of course, which...
Yeah.
I think any medievalist knows that she wasn't, because this is a very traditional way for women to hold their garments up.
Yeah.
But you actually tried on a version of this.
Yeah.
And it's damn heavy, yeah?
So heavy. I mean, that's really the most fascinating thing. It's finding that the stance, the way she's been painted in this portrait, is exactly how you stand.
You
have to lean back a bit to be able to grab the weight of the fabric.
Because there's the fur. Is the fur all the way underneath as well?
Fully lined in the one that we did. Obviously not real fur. We used fake fur. Ninia consulted with a fur expert. Now, the fur actually has been the subject of some debate since the show was on. Traditionally, it's largely thought to be minerva, like squirrel, the underbelly of squirrels. Ninia and her fur expert thought that it could possibly be Arctic fox. Because, interestingly, in a lot of paintings that have used minerva, because what you're seeing is small strips of fabric joined together, some artists actually depict these joins in the paintings. This portrait has no joins.
Mm.
Now, of course, you get into a sort of methodological dilemma here, because it could be artistic license.
It could also be virtuosity, that the original was trying to show no seams, that they're so good and so exquisite that they can hide the seams. But so Arctic Fox was proposed as a solution.
Now, obviously, no Arctic Foxes were hurt in the making of this programme. So no need to worry about that. But it was fully lined with fake fur. So, I mean, you can imagine the heat and the weight. Just, like, absolutely. I mean, I've not worn and likely will never wear anything like it again.
And it was incredible. So, I mean, difficult to move in? Did you have much mobility?
Not too much mobility, no. You could move around in it, but, you know, you're trailing this absolute weight around with you.
Yeah.
You certainly couldn't move very fast. You can move, you can walk around, but you wouldn't be, like, running a marathon or anything, you know, at all. I mean, it's, which obviously is all part and parcel of the purpose for this gown. She's not meant to move. She's supposed to be, you know, look so wealthy that she doesn't have to move. She's obviously not involved in any kind of manual labour.
Servants will do everything for her and she will be weighted on hand and foot. And I suppose the closest modern parallel we have, of course, is the bridal gown, that sometimes when a woman is in their bridal gown, they can't move, they're restricted. And in a sense, it's that idea of the floating lady, the eternal sort of maiden.
Yeah.
But actually, it's saying something social, isn't it, about her social standing, that she is that important.
Definitely. And also, well, in the case of this painting, people think that the Arnolfinis were likely very wealthy cloth merchants. So in some ways, this could almost be read as an advertisement for their wares.
Yes.
You know, we see these folds and folds and folds of this sumptuous green wool. Green was quite difficult to dye, because obviously it takes two colours. It's not just a one dye process.
Well, you and I have both got a bit of a passion now for dyeing the old-fashioned way.
Absolutely.
It's a magic, isn't it?
I absolutely loved it.
Because we work with the same person. The woman that you were doing the
Debbie.
Dyeing with. Yeah, Debbie, I did some with her as well. And it is like alchemy.
It really
when she
is.
Puts it in those cauldrons and spins it around, it comes out like bright yellow. And you just think, oh my goodness,
I absolutely loved it. I really did. And the vibrancy,
yeah.
You just don't think, you know, we're so used to thinking about the past in black and white because of photos or because things age, but it was there was so much vibrancy.
Well, it's almost garish. This is the thing I'm always saying. I mean, even in this setting here, you know, if you did go into a medieval church, or I mean, this is dated to 1434, that's a high medieval, early Renaissance environment. Very, very colourful. Everything's lavish and colourful. And actually, it's paintings like this that remain as that document, aren't they, really?
Yeah,
because this is colourful, it's lush. I mean, the bed in the background, the seat with this red velvet everywhere. It's probably a drawing room, isn't it? This is sort of an invitation space.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and there are, you know, textiles play such an important part in this painting.
Yeah.
Not only what she's wearing, but, you know, he is dressed in the height of fashion with this incredibly distinctive hat, of course, and all the drapery around them as well. But it's interesting you mentioned medieval churches, because when I was researching this painting, one of the most interesting theories I actually came across was the idea, so this, the fake idea that she's pregnant that we have, and you mentioned, you know, we see this in a lot of imagery from this time. We even see it when women are depicted nude. They're depicted with this kind of protruding stomach.
Well, his Ghent altarpiece, where he has Adam and Eve,
Eve
is shown in that, with that physique.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. Now, that absolutely fascinated me. One of the theories I read was that it was all sort of to do with the Gothic aesthetic, that it was mirroring that kind of swelling you get in Gothic architecture. I just thought that was such a fantastic idea.
Honestly, it's so exciting when you think about it. It's the burgeoning body, but it's one of the things that Van Eyck, the more you look into the time and that he made his paintings and the subject matter he depicted, there's this amazing painting that he does of the Virgin inside a Gothic church where she's extended up to 70 feet. And it's because there's this really interesting progression of the cult of the Virgin Mary at this stage, where she's seen as ecclesia, the church, and she's the body of all the faithful.
Oh,
and so
wow.
The sort of swelling to encompass all of the faithful, it's amazing.
That's
so there's always symbolism. And I think, you know, that's what's so amazing about this painting as well. Every detail has potentially got a whole narrative behind it, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And for me, that idea of that particular idealised female body, whether it's, you know, whether it's referring to an idea of fecundity, even though there were many, like, virgins who were depicted in this way as well. But I found that so interesting. So much of the work I do at London College of Fashion, especially when we teach there, we, you know, you can't theorise around clothes without thinking about the body.
Absolutely.
Underneath it. So some of the first classes that we teach our design students are about feminist theory, about the body, basically, and about changing beauty ideals through history.
Wow.
So for me to come across this kind of female shape that to us today, you know, is the sort of antithesis of the sort of classical ideal, I suppose, to come across this as a kind of ideal female form was absolutely fascinating. I was so interested.
So much about both of them is obviously the aesthetic of the time, because her face, even her hair, the way that her hair has been braided into these particular patterns, but the very, very long forehead that she's been given, which is almost unnatural. I mean, Van Eyck, when he does his portraits, he will bring a bit of poetic license to things like the height of the forehead, but that's seen as a real sign of nobility, a sign of regalness, you know, that the higher the hairline, the better. And then we have our chap over here. Now, I understand that his hat is actually made of straw. Have I got that wrong?
I have read both straw and I've read beaver as well.
Yeah, you see, beaver seems more sensible. Yeah. I'm not sure it looks like straw, because he's certainly got this amazing tabard, which is, again, is fur-lined. But the way that Van Eyck has caught the luster, that is done through two contrasting colours, the sort of the browny purple and the bright blue. And that gives that sheen, doesn't it, of the material. So again, I think you're probably right. It's like a catalogue or an advert for what they're selling, isn't it?
What they were selling, exactly. I think that's a really good theory, to be honest. Mm. And also in the colour green, the art historian we spoke to on the show, she talked about it representing money as well. Ooh. Also, it was a colour that was often worn around May Day, which again have this association with sort of fertility, even though we know she's not pregnant. There are still these kind of, you know, associations going on in this painting.
Yeah.
It just keeps giving and keeps giving. And you can see why people have just been obsessed with it for centuries, really.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
One of the things that's so magical about it, of course, is that it's got this perspective, this sense of perspective, fixed point, which is absolutely exquisitely done here, isn't it? Because obviously the lines all converge around this sort of area. You could say around the mirror that almost feels like an eye in the centre, but it's beautifully done so that the roof recedes, the window recedes, and the mirror is one of the big enigmas in this, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, for us today in the 21st century, that has a whole new meaning, I suppose, doesn't it? It's, you know, you can, the argument is you can see the artist in there. It's almost like a selfie.
Yeah.
You know?
But this is the thing as well, because mirrors, I mean, I often say this, what else is exciting in this is that you've got glass. I mean, that excites me, because you can see the attempts at just only one panel of it is glass.
It's gorgeous.
But it's not, at this stage, even in the 15th century, it's very, very hard to create large panels of clear glass. So these are sort of like bottle ends that are stuck together.
Brilliant.
But things like that we take for granted, glass, reflective surfaces, those are incredibly hard to make at this point. So just the fact they have those two elements on display, that's like new technology, it's sort of fancy households.
Exactly. There. Again, it's just all about sort of saying we are completely up to the minute, we are very, very wealthy, we have the latest technology, we have the latest fashions. you know, this is us. We're very, very important people.
Exactly. Right down to the origin. Oranges. Oranges. Come on, do this word. Right down to the oranges.
Yeah.
Which I think are, again, a sign of trade and exchange and wealth, aren't they? Because they're very desirable in the Netherlands at this point.
Definitely. And even also the colours that the man is wearing. We think of that today as being quite sombre.
Mm.
But actually, again, black, very, very expensive, very difficult to create. And these sort of plum tones that you see as well. Purple, of course, always associated with nobility, with the absolute sort of highest status. Again, very, very difficult to produced,
but it goes right back to imperial purple.
Yeah,
the use of shells to create that for the imperial household, and I think that it is a regal color, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
I think even the blue sleeves, because again, this was something else I was fascinated about in the program, was the under. Because there's a whole layer of clothing underneath the green dress as well, isn't it? And indeed, underneath his tabard, he's wearing a full black smock as well.
Yeah,
but the flash of blue. The display of the bands around the wrist, it's all suggested extra layers of wealth, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And also, if you can see on the belt, we've actually got sort of gold embroidery on the belt as well that matches the bracelet.
Gosh, I've never seen that. Yeah, of course.
It's really, we had this created, you couldn't quite see it in the show, but with this beautiful gold embroidery on the belt.
Right.
So, I mean, it really is down to the last detail, just conspicuous consumption.
Exactly. Advertising their own wealth.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that the idea that this is, I mean, there's lots of different theories for what's going on in this image, as I mentioned right at the top. Is it a marriage? There was a whole fantastical element of understanding, which was, is it in fact that she's pregnant and they're having to do a quickie marriage to validate it?
I
don't think so.
Yeah.
But we do have two witnesses in the back.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is a trick that some of the greatest artists employ, people like Velázquez, where you have a mirror reflecting back, and Manet, of course, in the Bar at the Folies Bergère, where you get the reflection of the person back. It's both virtuosic from the point of view of the artist, but it does also suggest the scale of the room and the fact that they are being witnessed. Something is potentially being witnessed here, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think that's an important element to the image. One of the other theories I've read was that this could possibly be a portrait of his late wife.
She's deceased.
And so this is almost like a memorial painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In which case, the idea of there being witnesses, you know, there has an even different sort of a poignancy to that.
Well, the single candle, is that the Panofsky argument? Because there's the single candle burning in the chandelier, isn't there?
Yeah.
Which could be that this is sort of a life snuffed out.
Yeah. And also, the Arnolfini is likely to be one of two different Arnolfini cousins.
Yes.
And one of them, his first wife, died a couple of years before this painting was painted, which is why people think it could be in remembrance of her.
I mean, there's so many different things that we can read symbolically. There's the dog of fidelity. I love the dog.
The dog is lovely.
The detailing. have you ever kind of zoomed in on it and macro? Because honestly, every single piece
just
of fur.
Like the light in his eyes and stuff. It's like really.
Well, this is one of the other exciting things that I was reading about with this. Can you see the amber prayer beads that hang next to the mirror?
Yes, yeah.
So every one of the reflections painted on there is reflecting back elements of the room on a microscopic level. So
that's
one
amazing.
Of the arguments is that Van Eyck is one of the first people to paint using a magnifying glass.
Wow.
Yeah, that he's actually managing to get that level of detail under magnification. Isn't that exciting?
That's really exciting.
I know.
And also that just the idea that there is so much glass and reflection going on in this anyway.
It's virtuosic.
The idea that he was possibly using that sort of cutting-edge technology as well, involving glass. It's just...
It's so exciting.
I mean,
I love the details, the little roundels on the edge of the mirror, because each one's a little miniature religious story, a little... stories from the Gospels, I think. And then, of course, you've got his graffiti.
Yeah.
he's brilliant, Van Eyck, because he does sign everything, which is quite... And he's the only one of the Netherlandish Northern Renaissance artists at this point who's signing.
Oh, right.
But he essentially, it says, Van Eyck was here.
Brilliant.
But he's used this leak. That's the other reason that it could be some sort of legal document, because the handwriting he's used is actually the one that you would get in legal documents. It's a legal hand.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh. So again, it kind of makes us think, is it a marriage contract? Or like you say, is it some sort of commemoration for the passing?
Yeah.
I mean, I just love it because of the intimacy of the scene. It is a small space. And actually, I always find it quite claustrophobic. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. But what adds to that feeling of claustrophobia is the volume of their clothes.
Right.
They take up so much of that space, don't they?
Yeah.
So, you know, which just kind of really, it adds to this, you know, we're too big for this space. We're, you know, again, we're just like, we're so important.
The ego.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is, yeah, I totally agree. And I hadn't thought, because it's the train. I think that's partly what makes me uncomfortable. The train actually comes up to the frame.
Yeah.
And again, yeah. I mean, this isn't the original, but Van Eyck used to paint and integrate his frames into the paintings. The frames took as much effort as the paintings.
Right.
And so there is a deliberate choice there to kind of rub it up against the frame, I think. And
yeah.
You do feel like the way the fixed point perspective has been done as well, yeah, they're bursting out of their space. They're bigger than this.
Definitely, exactly. Yeah. One of the other things that interests me about this is that I think it's a great example of a painting where studying fashion history can really add something to certain art historical interpretations. Yeah. Some early interpretations that very much focused on the idea of it being about fertility said that she is barefoot, but we can't actually see her feet, you'll notice in here. So people assumed she was barefoot because there are
discarded
these supposed
slippers,
shoes around. But what these actually are, they're not shoes, as you know. They're patterns, they're overshoes, so they'd be worn over your actual shoes to protect your shoes when you're walking around in the grime of the streets.
Exactly.
So having that knowledge of fashion history can actually, you know, help to dispel that previous sort of art historical theory.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, there's been so many things written about this. One of the ideas for the discarded shoes is that they're about to take to the marriage bed to consummate their marriage.
Yeah.
Again, with a complete misunderstanding of what these things were. What they're really showing is this is an interior space.
Exactly.
That you wouldn't wear those overshoes inside here because you're now in the lush interior of your own domestic dwelling, aren't you? And I mean, there's lovely suggestions of the outside world. The cherry tree in flower outside just hinted at. And you can even see more of the window reflected back in the mirror. So there is the suggestion of the outside world, but it's what the Dutch are so... It's what the sort of Northern Renaissance artists are so good at doing, which is these interior domestic settings that are just so unique to them and so brilliantly done. This is a genre painting in many ways, isn't it? Genre painting.
Yeah, that's true. It is very. It does feel quite confined, doesn't it? You're right. You've got these hints of the outdoor world, but it does feel like they are kind of... They're confined to this space.
I mean, I think it's it went on to inspire. I mean, this whole exhibition is called Van Eyck and the Pre-Raphs, but it's about this idea that this painting, with its many layers of symbolism, went on to inspire the Pre-Raphs in a time when they were also trying to bring this level of symbolism and meaning and potential kind of religious narrative to secular scenes out in the time of Victorian morality.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also, I mean, you get that sort of resurgence of the idea in, you know, people like William Morris in the mid-19th century really trying to bring back pre-industrial ideas of art and craft, going back to the guilds, you know, going back to non-mechanized means of production, really drawing on the medieval era as this sort of pinnacle of cultural artistic expression, really.
And even the name Pre-Raphaelites, Pre-Raphael, I mean, this is the sort of thing. It was exhibited for the first time around 1830 and in London. I think it was this image that was seen very much as the inspiration for everything you've gone on to say, this rise of fascination with the handmade, with the skill of the creator, not just as the fine arts, but in terms of multimedia, textile, and tiling, and enamelling, metalwork. And so we see this sort of pattern where this painting has continued to influence.
Exactly.
I mean, it is an absolute classic.
It is. And I mean, it's had so many different lives, as we've seen. It's influenced so much culture. It's influenced, you know, I think some of the Pre-Raphaelite images we're surrounded by, that's how many of us think of the medieval era now.
Absolutely.
It's through that Victorian
representation. You couldn't be more right. Absolutely. Medievalisms, rather than going back to the true medieval. Absolutely. And I mean, they're only doing their own version of an interpretation of this, which has its own flaws as well. And I think that's the beauty of looking at a painting like this, is every generation, every new the social environment brings its own levels of interpretation to it, doesn't it? That's art history theory,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
But
yeah.
I think that it's exciting, and I'm so jealous of the fact you got to immerse yourself in this painting through the outfit. That must have been a once in a lifetime thing. Yeah?
It totally was. I mean, it completely was. It was absolutely just unbelievable. We're actually the show that's on next week.
I'm really excited about it. It's The Black Prince,
isn't
it?
The Black Prince. Yeah.
So did you get? Sorry, I know this is going off on one because again, I live in Woodstock. That's where he was born. But his tabard and everything is above the grave in Canterbury.
Yeah.
Did you get access to the original to see?
We did.
Yeah.
We did. It was so exciting. It was so exciting. Because, you know, you mentioned earlier the fact that it's so difficult to find extant garments
exactly.
of a certain age. Textiles deteriorate. So few remain. So the jupon of the Black Prince is absolutely invaluable in terms of dress history, you know, cultural history. So to be able to see it was like mind-blowing.
I'm going to have to get loads more out of you once we've finished recording, because that just excites me so much. The making, like you say,
definitely.
The creation of these things is
fascinating. And you know, earlier you were talking about things appearing maybe sort of slightly gaudy to our eye. Wait until you see the Black Prince.
Hell yeah.
Oh my
God. It's
going to
be heraldry central. Have you seen the Luttrell Psalter, where you see the Lord Luttrell, and he's got his wife, his daughter, his horse, himself, his helmet, everything decked out in his coat of arms, and
Amazing.
It just looks like the most gaudy thing you've ever seen.
I love it.
OTT.
Really, yeah.
It's like Louis Vuitton on everything. But anyway, there's so many things that are exciting about what you're doing. I'm so excited to follow your work and carry
Thank
on
you.
And see what
Thanks.
You go on and do. And I know you're writing at the moment, aren't you?
I am. I'm writing another book at the moment, which is going to be out this September.
Oh, exciting. What's that on?
Yeah, it's called The Fashion Chronicles.
Ooh.
And what it is, it's kind of, I'm looking at what I have termed 100 of the best dressed people in history.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And so I'm basically looking at people and how they've used clothing in the past, going right back to ancient history and right up to Beyonce. So.
Oh, my goodness. This is so going to be on my Christmas list. This is my kind of book. And you're on Twitter, you're on Instagram.
On all of those, at Amber Butchart.
Excellent.
So you can find me there. You can contact me through there. And hopefully the series will still be on iPlayer when this goes out as well.
Fingers crossed. And also, is this the last in the series that goes out?
No, we've got The Black Prince, and then the final one the following week is Marie Antoinette.
Oh, God, it just gets better and better. I'm fanning myself here, detective listeners. It's been an unbelievable pleasure. Listeners, you'll be able to find a high-definition version of the Arnolfini portrait. Do zoom in on it. That's one of the most fun things to do, to get right in and see the microscopic detail of this. Hope you've enjoyed the podcast. We've got loads more exciting ones to come. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I will be posting lots more art detectors for you soon. Amber, you're a star. This has been
Thanks
amazing.
Thanks for having me. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.